I'm Yadvinder Mali. I'm Professor of Ecosystem Science in this department, and my work focuses on a range of aspects around tropical forests. The talk I'm giving here is an overview of how tropical forests fit within Earth system science, and it's almost an exact copy of a talk I gave as a presidential keynote at the Association for Tropical Biology and Conservation, which was in Kuching in Malaysia in July this year. So I think there's a handful of you who were there in Kuching, and apologies, you're seeing almost exactly the same talk as I gave then. But I thought it just gives a little bit of a broad overview of where tropical ecosystem ecology has contributed to understanding how tropical forests fit in the Earth system. And I'll particularly focus on one particular question that my group's been working on, which is the instability of the carbon cycle of the tropics and how we do research in that area. And as a tropical ecologist, one of my favourite aspects of tropical ecology is tropical fieldwork being out in the field, in the forest. And I'm also a bit of a science fiction fan, and so one of my favourite things to do while doing fieldwork is to get a glass of whiskey and sit in a hammock under the stars and imagine myself on some exotic jungle planet of a science fiction novel, so where you can see the Milky Way above, this infinite universe above, and this infinite biological universe around me, the rich diversity of tropical forests, of the endless levels of diversity that we're only beginning to understand and describe. And sitting between these two infinities is one of the real pleasures, I think, of tropical forest fieldwork. But one thing I've increasingly realized over my research, and one thing I'll try and convey to you over the next few slides, is that we do, in some senses, live on a tropical planet, in the sense that the tropical biosphere dominates the global biosphere, and changes that happen in the tropical biosphere have planetary consequences. And one way to look at this is through a technique that one of our former colleagues here in geography, who's now at the University of Iceland in Reykjavik, Ben Hennig, developed this approach of cartograms. And in these cartograms, the area represents the magnitude of that particular quantity. So in this particular version that we did for this summer presentation, it is now published in the Geographical magazine, we took data on the productivity of land regions and converted them and morphed them into a cartogram. So if you look as an annual average, you see this pattern, that the tropics are bloated relative to their geographical magnitude because of their higher levels of productivity, and some areas such as the desert regions, the Sahara shrinks to almost nothing, Australia becomes much smaller in overall size, Siberia becomes smaller, those areas with lower productivity become smaller. So this is, in some ways, a view of the terrestrial biosphere through metabolic eyes and through biological activity eyes. It's a map of how the Earth looks in terms of the overall magnitude of land biological activity. Of course, there's a lot going on in the oceans as well, we're not talking about that is of similar sort of magnitude, but just looking at the land regions, this is how the Earth looks. And you can see the tropics are much more important when you look at it through this projection. If you look at it through different seasons, things can be even more striking. So in January, when the Northern Hemisphere more or less shuts down biologically, you can see the biggest country on Earth is Brazil in terms of that biological activity. But even the relatively small countries like Ghana up here are almost the size of Western Europe in terms of their biological productivity at that time. So the tropics particularly dominate for half of the year when the Northern Hemisphere continents have biologically largely shut down. If you go to some...
Is the projection actually like the standard that distorts all the northern and southern...
It's an area-based projection, so the size there... I'm not quite sure whether the...
So it's actually real.
Yes. So the area of any, the overall area there is the reflects the biological activity under that projection. So if you go to July, when the great northern continents have also have long summer's days and extensive photosynthesis, you see a more balanced picture. So Siberia and North America are also substantially contributing to productivity. And what we can do is calculate these maps for month by month, and then you can come up with this sort of animation. which I always see as the beating heart of the biosphere. You can see it's a relative shift. Of course, the tropics aren't actually growing and shrinking. It's the northern hemisphere that's expanding and shrinking. But relatively, this is the shift of biological activity on the land surface throughout the year, this beating heart of the biosphere. And this gives you again this average, which in some ways is a measure of the biological activity of tropical land regions or of land, the biosphere as a whole. And one other aspect of our work that interests me is how human activity measures relative to the biological activity, and what is the metabolism of human activity, and how is that changing over time. And the many metrics that we have of human activity, one thing in a similar cartogram type approach is we can look at economic activity, and you can see GDP wealth here, and as one metric of that, and see how different parts of the region, some with absolute per capita high levels, such as North America and Europe, but others with a low per capita but high population density, such as China and India. That's a measure of the overall economic activity of humanity. But one thing that interests me is, can we compare these two? Can we compare human economic activity with planetary biological activity? And one thing we have to do there is come up with common currencies, common units for doing that. And one thing that we do is convert everything into energy. So in terms of the biosphere, we can talk about the energy flowing through organisms and the process of photosynthesis and metabolism. And in terms of human activity, we can talk about the energy embodied in the resources that we consume, both our direct biological energy, the direct energy use we all in electricity for and other forms, but also the energy embodied in the materials we consume, the infrastructure that supports our societies, and that's often called the social metabolism. And one thing that interests me is trying to compare this biological metabolism and social metabolism and how it's changed over time. What we can do is compare the energy flowing through natural systems by understanding the photosynthesis and the productivity, and compare it to the energy flowing through human systems. And if we do this at a planetary scale, we can come up with these sorts of calculations spanning human history. Firstly, by surveying the productivity of the land surface, we can estimate how much energy is flowing through the land surface, the metabolism of the land surface. And this is fairly well described. It's around 150 terawatts. A watt is a joule of energy per second, so it's a rate of flow of energy. A terawatt is 10 to the 12 watts, so this is the flow, so it's a billion watts. And this is the flow of energy through photosynthesis in the biosphere. And we can compare that by doing a variety of calculations. What is the total energy flow through the global human population in their resource consumption, their biological metabolism, their infrastructure? And if we do these calculations for pre-agricultural humanity, what we find as a hunter-gatherers, there was a low population density that were able to be supported by that lifestyle, and it had a relatively low impact on the landscape. And roughly, the amount of energy flowing through humanity was around 0.002% of the biosphere energy. Probably there was more energy flowing through other vertebrate species like elephants at that time than there was flowing through humans. But if you convert that into equivalent area of tropical forest, how much chemical energy is flowing through a tropical forest? How large does it have to be to match the energy flowing through humanity? It's probably equivalent to around 1,000 square kilometers of tropical forest. So a modest-sized area of forest has the equivalent biological energy. So if we move forward to around the 17th century, so there's been the Neolithic, the agricultural revolution, but prior to, and that's developed over time, but it's prior to the Industrial Revolution. So there's a much greater use of energy per capita. Agriculture, it can be seen as the colonization of ecosystems, turning them from something directed towards human use of those systems. So the growth, the biological growth in that ecosystem is directed towards human use. Also, it supports much higher population densities than hunter-gatherer lifestyles. So if we estimate the global population and the global metabolism around 1700, the total energy flowing through humanity is around 3 terawatts, so much bigger than in the hunter-gatherer population, and that, but about 2% of terrestrial biosphere energy. So that circle there roughly represents that magnitude of humanity compared to the planet, which is the terrestrial metabolism, a biological metabolism, which is the area of the whole planet in that image. And in terms of area, that's roughly equivalent in tropical currencies to the area of Borneo and Sulawesi in Southeast Asia, or the Brazilian state of Mato Grosso, or the country of Bolivia. So to give you an idea of the scale of energy flowing through the biosphere compared to the scale of the energy flowing through humanity. If we extend to modern times and the industrial society, we have much greater per capita energy use, much higher population densities supported in our dense cities. And if we scale to that, where we're approaching the energy flowing through humanity is about 17% of the energy flowing through the biosphere. So that's equivalent roughly to all the biological energy flowing through Amazonia. So it's becoming significant. If you think of the vast area of Amazonia and the energy flowing through that, that's how much energy is flowing through humanity. And if you project forward, by 2050, under a mid-range UNDP projection, we're approaching about 32% of biosphere energy, which is equivalent to the total amount of energy flowing through tropical forests worldwide. So as a biome, humanity becomes similar in magnitude to the entire global tropical forest biome in terms of the energetics of the Earth system. And if you project to something like global China, where everybody has the same per capita metabolism of energy use of the average Chinese citizen today, we're at 40%, and you can see the circle getting larger and larger. And if we get to global USA, where everybody has the same per capita energy consumption as the average North American, we exceed the energy flow through the entire land biosphere. And so this is clearly something that is unsustainable in terms of total energetic flow on a finite biosphere. And it's partially sustained because much of our energy comes from non-biosphere sources, currently mainly fossil fuels, but in the future, increasingly renewables and other sources of energy. But it clearly encapsulates the challenge we face in this model of metabolic expansion that has propagated for the last century or two, is facing these fundamental challenges of us being on a finite planet with a limited total amount of capacity of this planet to both provide our resources and absorb the waste from our activities. So this matters. The size of our metabolism matters, because it isn't just about the climate change or other aspects. It determines the degree on which we're exploiting the resources available in the biosphere, leading to overfishing, overharvesting, depletion of key resources to feed this huge metabolism, and where the waste products of this metabolism go. CO2 from our metabolism driving climate change, ocean acidification, plastics, human and industrial waste, and also this vast metabolism occupies physical space, and that leaves less space for the other inhabitants of the biosphere at all scales. So there's increasing pressure on habitats for other species, and this I think is a one of the fundamental challenges of our time. It is much more than, say, the climate change problem alone. It's this manifestation. Even if you solve the climate change problem by coming up with a clean energy source that transforms our energy economy, many of the other challenges still remain. So maybe even become even more abundant if we have abundant and cheap energy. And this challenge has been it can be addressed in two ways. One is by limiting the size of this metabolic footprint. The other one is the more there's internal circulation of energy or resources within that metabolism, the less that metabolism imposes on the biosphere and the biological world. So that's one way of framing the two approaches that we have to limiting this. And there's a phrase that's often used to encapsulate this concept, and this is the idea that we're in the Anthropocene, this new geological epoch, where humanity has become, through its large metabolic footprint, has become an overriding influence on planetary processes, and faces a number of challenges in how we negotiate our future pathway in this planetary period. So human influence, this could be a measure of our metabolism, this blue line increasing over time, and it's approaching the level now where we face a number of planetary or regional boundaries where this metabolism is swamping the regional or the planetary biological metabolism, and that leads to all the challenges that we face in our century. So one key question scientists that we can ask is also, how can we determine where these boundaries are? How much room do we have to maneuver before we start breaching or are already breaching some of these boundaries, and what can we do to retreat from breaching these boundaries? And these are questions that can be asked at any scale, at any biome of the biosphere, but in particular my career and my group's work is focused on the tropical ecosystems in particular, and seeing tropical ecosystems through the lens of increasing human influence and presence. So in the tropics, you see a number of aspects that are linked to this expanding human influence. Some of these can be simple intensification and extension of pre-existing pressures. You know, humans in many parts of the world have been interacting with their environments for thousands of years. But new technologies, new demographic pressures, population pressures have increased and intensified those pressures, even though that interaction with the environment has been something that's been persisting for thousands of years. New technologies can change the nature of those interactions. So in particular, the chainsaw and the shotgun are probably the two most important technologies that have transformed human environment relationships, even in areas that have a long history of human environment interactions. And increased connectivity is a key feature of the Anthropocene. So areas of the world that were once remote, such as the heart of Borneo, are now converted into mass consumption oil palm landscapes that feed global palm oil demand. There are many other examples, cattle ranching and soybean expansion in previously very remote regions of the Amazon. And then another key feature are these planetary mechanisms, these interactions and these boundaries. So how climate change could be affecting, which is a result of our metabolism and the amount of CO2 being released from our metabolism, how that's affecting regional climate and possibly kicking off feedbacks where climate change causes further release of CO2 from the biosphere that causes further climate change. And that last one is something that is a particular interest and will be a focus of the second half of my talk. And there's some debate about whether these boundaries exist for the biosphere as a whole, whether there is, if you degrade the biosphere enough in terms of its composition of species, whether you reach some sort of tipping point state where there's a fundamental shift in the functionality of the biosphere as a planetary metabolism. This review paper by Tony Banowski and others argue that as you start to increase the degradation of the biosphere in terms of species loss or habitat loss, there's a critical transition point which shifts the biosphere into a more degraded state. It could be debatable whether this exists at a global level. Others argue that, yes, these points may exist at local levels, but at the global level, there isn't really a threshold. You could have situations where one biome is very heavily degraded, but that doesn't have planetary consequences for other biomes. And really, it's much more important to focus at the local and the regional level of these questions rather than framing them in a planetary sense. But all these approaches agree that, at least at the regional level, there is the potential for thresholds or tipping points, where if a system is pushed far enough, it may be pushed into a new state that it's hard to recover from, even if that initial pressure diminishes or reduces. And this is something that is a key aspect of focus in my work. And the tropical forest, and in particular the Amazon forest, has been conceived as one possible key region where such a tipping point exists, that if the forest starts getting degraded enough, either through direct degradation, through logging or clearance of enough area of forest, or indirectly through climate change, causing a degree of drying and dieback or fires, then that forest itself might become release more CO2, but also start evaporating and transpiring less water, which further dries the regional climate, causing a further reduction in water supply, and there's a feedback cycle that could flip the system into a much less productive, much more degraded biome. And a number of climate modelling studies, starting by the seminal one by Peter Cox and others, which was the first attempt to couple a biosphere model with an atmospheric model, and they had scenarios. When they played these scenarios forward, there was a suggestion that initially the biomass of the tropical forest increases because higher CO2 is stimulating the growth of forests, but at some point climate change kicks in to be a major factor that starts causing a loss of biomass, and a release of carbon from the tropical forest. And these were quite simplistic models, this first generation, and they become more nuanced over time. And so there's still a lot of debate about to what extent such a feedback mechanism exists. So key questions we have in this context are, how do we identify these boundaries? Where is the safe operating space? How much can we clear tropical forests for agriculture or harvest for timber before we risk perhaps running into these regional scale feedbacks? And what role do these tropical biomes play in determining regional and planetary boundaries? So is there a danger at some point that the amount of release of CO2 or the change in water supply from the tropics starts having planetary consequences in terms of climate change? And also, what types of science can we employ to address these questions? And a key science that has emerged over the last few decades, that is the science that works at the level to address these questions, is Earth System Science. And when I developed this talk, it was to an audience of tropical ecologists. And what I'm trying to convey in the next few slides is what Earth System Science is and how it can complement traditional tropical ecology to look at some of these questions. And often some of the new sciences, when they emerge, are driven by new technologies. And Earth System Science is a relatively new science that emerged around 3 decades ago, but has become a predominant science in the way we analyze environmental change. And just to give you an older example of how technologies shape science, this is one of the first microscopes. This was used by Robert Hooke, and he used it to peer at the microcosmos amongst the first to do that, and to describe what he saw with this new technology. And this is a book, Micrographia, Physiological Descriptions of Minute Bodies Made by Magnifying Glasses, which describes what he did. And there was a magnificent age of science where you could just have a new technology and say, interesting things that I saw when down my microscope. And here's an example of these beautiful illustrations that were produced from this new technology, and this beautiful detailed image of a flea. And here's an image of cells of cork, and also this was the first time, this is the first description of the cell, the realization that biological organisms were made up of these units, these smaller units, and ultimately that led to a whole new theory of biology, the cell theory of biology, and that was only possible initially because a new technology opened up information that enabled a theory to then follow to describe and encapsulate that information. And Earth System Science has similarly evolved, and rather than the microscopes that Hooke and others employed, what has really driven Earth System Science forward is the employment of macroscopes, things that enable us to see things that are too big for our normal scale of senses to perceive. And the key macroscopes that I employed, I think, are two. One is satellite remote sensing that enables us to see the Earth as a whole, as an integrated whole, and see the interactions between these components of the Earth system. And the other one is computer modeling at scale that enables us to simulate the functioning of the Earth system and start playing experiments with the Earth, where we look at different scenarios, different interventions, and play them through. Both of these things are now so common in sciences now, we almost take them for granted, but they're really new technologies, new ways that first appeared in the 60s and 70s, but really you could argue it's only almost in the last decade with the advent of things such as Google Earth that it became democratized, that it became something that didn't require specialist knowledge, that anyone could start exploring the Earth with these macroscopes. So what Earth system science does is exploit these macroscopes and look at ways of understanding the interactions of the biosphere using these lenses of satellite data and ecosystem modeling. And this is something that it's really been able to contribute to our understanding of these questions around the biosphere. Great, so Earth system science is a science that examines the Earth as an integrated system, incorporating its physical, biological, chemical, and human dimensions. And just to showcase, there's a whole range of tools that you could show and how Earth system science works. But just an example, there are tools such as this Global Forest Watch that provides you at annual or even monthly resolution patterns of change of land use in the tropics. Anyone, non-specialist, you could be an NGO, you can be an indigenous group or others wanting information on land use threats and pressures, and you can go to this website and see these patterns in detail. And there's an abundance of data available at scales and a level of availability that is extraordinary. Another one that's very different, but it's one of my favorite examples of contemporary satellite technologies. There's a satellite system called GRACE, which is two satellites that orbit the Earth, and as they experience different gravitational fields in the Earth's orbit, they move slightly further or slightly closer together, and that distance is measured very precisely by laser, and from that they can work out distortions in the Earth's gravitational field. And when you look at that over time, this geoid captures that. The major feature that drives that distortion is changing amounts of water on the land surface. So when there's more water, there's a slightly more gravitational pull, a minuscule amount, but there is slightly more gravity over an area with lots of water. And through distortions in the gravity field, you can detect the amount of water and how it varies over time. So this geoid shows the seasonal variation in the Earth's gravitational field. It's greatly enhanced. But you can see this pulse, let's say in Amazonia, as it dries and wets, and the gravitational field of the entire Amazon is shifted by the amount of water going in there. And I still takes my breath away. This is amazing that we can detect such small distortions in distances between two satellites and infer the water balance of the planet from such tools. And on the modeling side, these Earth system models have been the real workhorse in our understanding of global influence and function of the biosphere and human influence on the Earth system. And they've greatly increased in capability over time. The acronyms here refer to different IPCC reports: first assessment, second assessment, third assessment, fourth assessment. And one thing you see is the resolution, the spatial resolution of these models has increased over time, but also the number of processes that are incorporated. So the early models, the early climate models, had carbon dioxide and rain and clouds. And then by the time we got to the second assessment report, we started having volcanic activity and sulfates and aerosols. The biosphere really only starts kicking in on the third assessment, when the carbon cycle starts being described, and then chemistry and more dynamic surface vegetation really only appears in the fourth assessment. So as the computational abilities of brought, our understanding of processes has improved, we're able to build more and more sophisticated models and start exploring the functioning of the Earth system. And an example of the types of thing we can do, this is just a simulation of atmospheric humidity based on observations and these model simulations. You can see, again, another type of heartbeat. You can see the day and night pulse of moisture in the tropics. So the sun goes over different tropical regions and you have a burst of evapotranspiration. So you see this pulse of moisture, especially when you go over the continental regions of the Congo and the Amazon. And we can employ these models to look at these questions of feedback. So we can look at how greenhouse gases change the climate, how the climate changes an ecosystem, and how that ecosystem changes and feeds back. So these are the tools that we need to understand whether there are positive feedback cycles, whether there are tipping points in the system, where the system may flip to another state. But there are challenges in this. The challenge is, as an ecosystem scientist, how sophisticated is our understanding of the ecosystem that enables us to have confidence in these feedbacks, and how sophisticated does it need to be? We know the biosphere is immensely complex, incredibly varied in its detail. We can't hope to capture all of that complexity in any model. How much complexity do we need to capture to have the key aspects that we need to, for the question we have at hand? This is something that the Earth System Modeling community tries to handle. And this is a paper that from a few years ago that looked at how the carbon stocks, the biomass of the tropical biosphere, would change under different climate models for the different regions. So you see, under these simulations, the suggestion is that the higher CO2 in the atmosphere is increasing the biomass of tropical forests generally, particularly in Africa and Asia. But in South America, there's some divergence. Some studies, the majority of studies say that biomass will continue to increase, but a significant number of studies, and particularly amongst the more sophisticated models, the Hadley Center models, which are amongst the most refined, suggest that there's some possibility of dieback, that there would be, the eastern Amazon becomes so dry that it becomes a source of carbon to the atmosphere, and you have a large-scale retreat. And the black lines here are observations from our field inventory networks in South America and Africa. And you see that what they're suggesting at the moment is that the actual rate of increase of biomass is larger than these models predict. Indeed, although it could flip, and there's evidence on the more recent studies that these observations are suggesting that these patterns are already beginning to flatten out, or will flatten out over the next decade. So this is one key question. And this uses a particular model called JULES, which is the UK ecosystem model, which is sophisticated in many aspects, but is still simple compared to the real biological system. And this is one of the key challenges that we face in representing the biosphere in Earth system sciences. How do we represent this complexity, or the key aspects of this complexity, at a scale that we can use in Earth system models? This describes one example, a relatively sophisticated model, the LPJ model, that has all these biological processes and has all these population dynamics, competition, mortality between key functional groups. And by using that, it tries to simulate these responses. And that's relatively sophisticated, but is it sophisticated enough? We don't know the definitive answer to that yet. And one thing we need are empirical data that speak between the complexity of pure biology and the moderate simplicity of Earth system science. And this has been a real challenge, finding the right level of data that can talk the same language of ecology and Earth system science. And so there's this key question: how much complexity is necessary and sufficient? And this is where I think a discipline of ecology has a particularly important role to play. And this is the science of ecosystems ecology, which has emerged as a discipline within ecology in around the 1920s and 1930s. And it can be described as the integrated study of living and non-living components of ecosystems and their interactions within an ecosystem framework. So prior to that, ecology had largely been focused on either species or populations, and describing what was there, well, why it was there, or how populations of those animals or plants varied over time. And what ecosystem ecology introduced is a focus on the interactions between organisms and between organisms and the physical environment, so the flows of energy, of resources in those organisms. And this really originated around the 1930s with Arthur Tansley, who first introduced this concept of the ecosystem and tried to emphasize the importance of exchanges of materials between organisms and their environment rather than just the organisms themselves. And in the tropics, the real pioneer was Howard Odum, and their work in the 1960s and 1970s where this is an example of, they try to describe energy flow, power flows through the forest of Luquillo in Puerto Rico. There's this tome which is sort of it's vast and it's quite impenetrable in places. You can find this in the library if you want to look at it. They had several years of funding, and they produced vast detailed description of the energy flows through this system. As it was the 1960s, they could do experiments like irradiate the forest with gamma rays to see what effect that had on the ecosystem. But it had a huge and seminal influence. The other significant work in the 1970s that had tried this approach was in Malaysia. It was a Japanese group led by Kira and others coming up with a similar types of description. This is the forest of Paso in peninsular Malaysia, describing the flow of energy or carbon, in this case, their equivalent, through a rainforest in Paso. And then, so there was a lot of this work and big investment in something called the Man and Biosphere Program in the late 60s, early 70s. And then it sort of ground to a halt from around the mid-1970s onwards. And it's interesting to speculate why that was. And I think it's a mixture of, there was a feeling that actually many of the sustainability questions that we were interested in couldn't be purely answered by this engineering type description of energy flows in a system. Certainly they contributed something, but given the amount of investment, they didn't actually answer the more subtle questions that we were interested in asking beyond simply describing the flows of energy. And also, I think it was partially because this type of science had nowhere to talk to. It was coming up with these descriptions that represented a level of abstraction of the detailed ecology of a system, but it didn't talk at that time to planetary questions, because we simply didn't have that planetary language that could engage with this. And this changed in the 80s and 90s with the development of Earth system science, when suddenly, at a planetary scale, we were asking questions around flows of carbon, of water, of energy, and needed data to actually inform those understandings. Also, data at a level that could mediate between the detailed complexity of ecology and the simplicity of Earth system science. And I think this is where this sort of integrated flow-type diagram approach to science suddenly had a new avenue where it could actually play a significant role in talking between these two disciplines of classical ecology and Earth system science. And so one key part of my team's work for the last 10 years is almost to revive this science of Odin and Kira without the gamma rays, where we try and come up with similar descriptions and try and do it for a range of forest ecosystems. So the one thing that's also become increasingly apparent is that the tropical forests are incredibly varied in their functioning. They're not one uniform green slab. The local ecology, history, biogeography, all these factors have a role in determining how a tropical forest functions. So our team, over the last decade, has been working at a range of sites across the tropics, initially a lot in Brazil and Peru, and more recently in Africa and Southeast Asia. We have a nice test site here in Whiteham, outside of Oxford, where a lot of these ideas are developed and tried out before we apply them in the tropics and some other sites in places such as the temperate rainforest of Chile. And we have a manual that describes this process. And what we try and do at these sites is resurrect those Odom-type, Kira-type diagrams for all these sites. And just to define some of the key concepts that we use in describing, for example, the carbon flow through a system, we can describe the photosynthesis, the amount of energy flowing in through photosynthesis. We can describe in carbon units as well. The metabolism of plants, which is typically around 70% of the photosynthesis, the energy used by the plants themselves, and then causing a release of CO2 from the plants back to the atmosphere. The energy that's converted into biological material, either in leaves, flowers, or fruits, whether in wood, whether in coarse roots or fine roots below ground. The rate at which that material then is converted into dead material, either through litter fall or root fall, or through a final mortality of the plants themselves, and then the breakdown of that material by fungi or bacteria or the rate of herbivory by invertebrates or vertebrates, which also releases that material back to the atmosphere. And this is one that a cycle that's predominantly focused on plants and microbes. In a few places, and Whiteham is one where we really pioneer this. We try and integrate that with studies of the animals to understand the amount of energy flowing through the animal system as well as the plant microbial system. But generally, 98% of the energy is flowing through this plant microbial system. So that's the thing that we tend to focus on. And there's a range of measurements we employ: detailed dendrometers to measure the rate of tree growth at monthly resolution, litter traps that measure the rate of productivity of leaves and flowers and fruit, ingrowth cores to measure the rate of root growth, rhizotrons, the screens in the ground that look at root dynamics and root growth, respiration studies that measure the rate of CO2 flow from the soil. So we put a chamber on the soil, measure the rate at which CO2 concentration in the chamber increases over a few minutes, and from that work out the rate of flow of CO2 out of the soil. Do various experiments with and without litter to look at the different components in the soil. Similar measurements on the stems of trees, and where we can, on the leaves, the rate of photosynthesis, the rate of CO2 release. And we couple this with observations of the climate, so we can understand how climate interacts with all these processes. And as an example, these are the type of diagrams, these new Odin Kira type diagrams that we come up with. This is a forest in Peru, in the Peruvian Amazon, and you can see this overall flow of energy that we describe. And there's a lot of detail in there, but one thing to point out is that the woody growth, the most apparent visible part of the ecosystem in terms of when we're looking at function, is only about 5 to 10% of the photosynthesis, of the total carbon coming in. Most of it ends up being used in the plant's metabolism. More goes into the leaves or in the roots than ends up in the actual woody growth that is the visible, long-lived part of the system. Here's a few photos of some places. This is that site in Peru that we've been monitoring since 2005. One of our favorite sites is this elevation gradient in the Peruvian Andes. So we're standing here at the tree line, looking down a valley, the Cosnipata Valley, into the Amazon lowland, and we've set up a number of study sites at various elevations going down this slope, which we use as a laboratory to understand how temperature controls ecosystem function. More recently, one example is we've been working in these oil palm landscapes of Borneo, where you've got fragments of forest, old growth forest, fragments of forest, and oil palm, and trying to understand the functioning and flow of energy and nutrients in these landscapes. And one particular focus has been Africa, which has been relatively neglected in tropical forest ecology compared to South America and Asia. And everywhere needs more research, but Africa in particular, and tropical forest Africa, needs a lot more activity. A few years ago, we did a study where we looked at a number of the major scientific journals and looked at around tropical forests and global change, whether it's climate change or logging or deforestation or hunting, and looked at where studies were being conducted. So we weren't looking where the authors were from, but we're mining the actual manuscript to see where was the actual field work conducted that led to that work, which requires a lot more effort than just simply mining the affiliations of the authors. And this is the map that we came up with. It's slightly out of date now, but broadly I think it still holds true. And you see the size of the circle is the number of publications coming out of that location. And what you see in this global study is that two sites dominate. Can anybody tell me what that big circle is?
BCI
in Panama, yes. Mm-hmm. And the other second circle there is La Selva in Costa Rica. And there's lots of excellent science going out of those two locations. I have no quarrel with all the work going on there. For historical reasons, they're particularly easy places for North Americans in particular to develop research programs. But in terms of understanding the functioning of the tropics as a whole, I'd say that this excessive focus on Mesoamerica distorts our understanding of tropical forests. They're both very particular sites. BCI is, in fact, is a secondary forest on an island fragment in the Panama Canal. So very unusual in the tropical, on relatively fertile soils, very unusual in the tropical context. And La Selva is also a fragment on relatively fertile volcanic soils, which is very atypical of the broader tropical forest biome. And yet much of our understanding of tropical ecology emerges from these very few sites. So one big push that we've had is try to get a more pan-tropical view on these questions. So if we plot those numbers of studies per unit area, you can see the numbers of studies per 100,000 square kilometres of tropical forest. You see this incredible dominance of Mesoamerica in our understanding of the tropics. Small tropical islands are dominated by studies in Hawaii, that also has prolific research. And other regions are small, but Africa is particularly small in this literature. And if you look at the key themes that are studied, this is a secondary part. If it, looking at global change drivers, about half of the literature is on atmospheric change and climate change, and then the other components contribute to all these other significant structural disturbances, about half, that's logging in particular. Climate change is about a third, and then the other bits are smaller components. So that's where the focus is at the moment. So we've focused quite a lot on trying to develop something in Africa. Our main focal countries in the last few years have been particularly Ghana, and then Gabon, and to a lesser extent Ethiopia and South Africa. And this is a point. Until a few years ago, there was no data from these sorts of sites from Africa, and we had a workshop on our project in Lopé in Gabon in 2016, and it started. So these were all the previously existing data from South America, and these are the data that we have from Borneo, from Southeast Asia, and there was nothing in Africa. So the result of this workshop was to produce these six bars there from Africa on the map, and that's a moment of celebration with our field team when we got that. And our Ghanaian colleagues were obviously keen not to fall behind the Gabonese. In this work, so a month later we had a similar workshop in Ghana, and then we added a lot more data. So now suddenly the African data sets are larger than the other tropical sites in terms of overall volume of data. So a bit of competition can be healthy in science. And there's a paper, this is one recent paper we've had, that describes some of this functioning in this Ghana wet-dry gradient. And this is our global team. It's a huge network of collaborators. There's a large team here that works on processing and analysing the data, but there's a much larger team of collaborators across the tropical continents that works on actually spending all this time in the field collecting these primary data. So now, for the last bit of my talk, I'm going to focus on how we use these sort of data to analyse or tackle Earth system science questions. And I'm going to focus on one that's particularly topical at the moment and has been a real focus of our work in the last year, and that's the El Niño, particularly focusing on using this global network that we have, focusing on how the El Niño of 2015 and 2016 affected the carbon cycle of the tropics. And this matters in our understanding because the tropical carbon cycle flickers. And this describes this flickering. The top two curves there show the amount of CO2 being emitted by human activity. And you see the steady emission from land use change, particularly in the tropics. And there's ever-increasing emissions from CO2, of CO2 from fossil fuel combustion, which dominates in that emission story. But one of the most striking features is that of all that CO2 that's emitted, just under half ends up as the observed rate of rise of CO2 in the atmosphere. About a quarter, or just under a quarter, more like a fifth, ends up in the oceans, being dissolved in the oceans. That has its own problems in causing ocean acidification, and the challenges around that. And about a third ends up in the biosphere, being absorbed by terrestrial ecosystems. But what's most striking about that fraction that's being absorbed in the biosphere is how unsteady it is. There's some years where a large amount is being absorbed in the biosphere, and other years where almost nothing is being absorbed in the biosphere. And that's interesting to understand as a question in itself, but a more acute question is this simple, interesting interannual variation, or is this flickering an early warning sign of a dangerous state in the biosphere that could flip to an alternative state where this land carbon sink disappears and all becomes even a carbon source. In which case the biosphere stops acting as a moderate brake on climate change and becomes an accelerator of climate change. And that could be a very clear definition of a tipping point that we want to avoid, because that would indicate at that stage that whatever we do in terms of our policy interventions to slow down anthropogenic emissions, the biosphere has kicked into momentum of its own and is moving forward to pushing the Earth into a new dangerous state, independent of what we do in terms of policy intervention. So that's clearly something we want to avoid. And an understanding whether this flickering is an early warning sign or whether it's just an interesting aspect of the ecology of the Earth system is a critical question. And we know this flickering is driven by the terrestrial tropics. So the tropical forests play a dominant role in determining this flickering. And we see that it's strongly linked to the temperature of the tropics. So the green line here is another way of saying it's the rate of rise of CO2 in the atmosphere. So it's the slope, the rate at which CO2 is increasing year on year. And the red line is the temperature of the tropics. And the shading here indicates when we have significant El Nino events, with a darker shading. So when an El Nino occurs, it's a natural oscillation in the climate system. The eastern Pacific becomes very warm, and that changes the entire circulation of the tropics. Areas that are usually quite wet, such as eastern Amazonia, become a lot drier. Indonesia becomes a lot drier. And it changes the water balance and energy balance of the tropics, and seems to cause this release of CO2. Now, there's an ongoing debate about whether El Niños will become more frequent or more intense. Jury's still out on that, and they may do under climate change, but it's not certain. But whatever the cause of this, there's a strong relationship between the temperature of the tropics and this surge of CO2 out of the tropics. So is this a sign that as the tropics warm under anthropogenic warming, we may see a surge of CO2 being released from the tropics? So we know that the tropics are the source of this variation, but there's lots of things that we don't know. Are specific tropical regions dominating this variability? What mechanisms are responsible for the anomaly? Is it reduced photosynthesis? Is it increased plant respiration? Is it or soil respiration or fire or tree mortality? Some of these perhaps are less worrying than others. If it's microbial activity in the soil, maybe that's microbes tend to adapt and acclimate to new situations relatively fast. So that would be interesting, but perhaps not as a source of as much concern as, say, tree mortality or fire or plant photosynthesis being reduced, things that are less likely to adapt in the short timescale of climate change. Which climate variables are most important to driving this response? And as I said, is this variability an early warning of longer-term instability in the tropical forest biosphere? And the last really strong El Nino prior to this one was in 97-98, where a lot of these tools, these macroscopes, were really in a very early form. There were some satellites, but nothing compared to the array of satellites we have now. Earth system modeling was at a relatively crude early stage compared to the detailed representation of what the biosphere and Earth system modeling. And so this 2015-2016 El Nino provided a real opportunity to test our integrated understanding of the Earth system and see where it was lacking, see where it did well. Last year we convened a meeting at the Royal Society where we tried to get people who use all these different tools, whether remote sensors or modelers or ecologists or field researchers, to look at this question from their own different discipline and lens. And just last week, or 2 weeks ago, we had a result of that, which is a special issue of Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society that came out that tries to synthesize that range of evidence, that testing. And it shows lots of really interesting results, but also it's leading to the next step where we're trying to actually come up with a coherent common understanding by comparing these tools directly, and that's the focus of our work over the next few months and year. But just to show you particularly our contribution to this, which is what we're seeing from these these field observations and trying to use those field observations to describe this pattern. So I'll talk a little bit about what our contribution has shown within this. And this is work that's been led by our postdoc Sami Rifai, which I think he's probably somewhere hiding in this audience. Down there, so you can ask him specific questions about that as well if you want. just to put this El Nino into context, in terms of magnitude, it was probably similar in magnitude to the 97-98 El Nino. So amongst the great strong El Ninos of the last century, but not necessarily that much stronger in itself. But what was striking, and it's always important to remember, is each El Nino occurs in the context of long-term climate warming. And so even if the magnitude of the El Nino is the same as the previous one, it's occurring in a warmer world. And here you see this in terms of annual mean temperature of tropical land regions, and the red are El Nino events, blue are La Nina events, the opposite. And you see 97-98, El Nino was, in total amplitude was quite large, and it caused a warming, but the 2015-2016 El Nino was of similar magnitude, but because it occurred in a warmer world, it pushed the tropics into unknown temperature space that it hadn't been at before. So, and even the mid conditions of that El Nino were stronger than the peak conditions of the previous strong El Nino. So each El Nino in the context of climate change is pushing the tropics into unexplored climate space. And so it provides, which is alarming, but also provides us an opportunity to understand whether there are thresholds in terms of tropical response as the climate warms and warms. It gives us almost a way of looking a decade or two into the future, when that state, that peak El Nino condition, will be the average condition of the tropics, as opposed to being an extreme anomaly condition as it is now. If we look in terms of rainfall, you see a similar pattern of no overall trend of rainfall in the tropics, but a strong decline in rainfall during these El Nino events. So key tropical regions, particularly Amazonia and Southeast Asia, tend to become much drier during an El Nino event. And if we map that spatial pattern, we see a pattern like this. This is the precipitation anomaly and the temperature anomaly with red areas with lower rainfall than average. And you see the last El Nino had a strong effect, particularly in Amazonia and in Southeast Asia, and to a lesser extent in parts of Africa. And Amazonia was particularly warm as a hot spot. The other areas were not so affected in terms of the temperature anomaly. There was some anomaly in some regions. And there are a number of ways that we can look at the CO2 question. One other technique we have, one other macroscope, is this global array of CO2 observations in the atmosphere that look at the pattern of variation of CO2 in the atmosphere. And when we couple that with the circulation model, which models how winds move the CO2 around the atmosphere, we can reverse those models and say, where's this pattern of CO2 emerging from? Which parts of the biosphere are releasing or absorbing CO2? And these sort of studies, this is one of the papers in that special issue, come up with this sort of map of the anomaly of CO2 in the atmosphere. So this is giving us a top-down clue as to whether particular regions of the tropics are particularly important in this flickering, this release of CO2. And you see Amazonia comes out as particularly strong, possibly southern Africa there as well, and possibly a little bit of Asia, but particularly Amazonia stands out as being particularly important. And this is a top-down view. What this view can't tell us is what the mechanism is. You can guess about it, but it doesn't tell us whether it's more soil respiration or reduced photosynthesis or some combination of the two. So what we can do with our ground observations is try and give a bottom-up view and scale that up and see whether that can tell us, both whether that can validate that Amazonia, for example, is the key source region, and also what mechanisms are driving that. So these green stars highlight some of the sites where we did this work in particular, and we had detailed measurements over this study. And I won't go through all the components in detail, but one for example is we use the dendrometers to measure growth of trees at either monthly or three-monthly intervals. And then once we have such a rich amount of data, we can build models, statistical models. So these aren't process-based models. They're just seeing what's in the data. And here's an example of woody growth and the range of variables that affect it, water deficit, temperature, and particularly atmospheric water stress, how dry the atmosphere is, has a significant effect. and we can build a statistical model that simply looks at the climate variations and the carbon cycle variations, and then we can demonstrate how it matches the data. So these are a number of our sites in Bolivia, in Malaysia, in southwest Amazonia and central Amazonia. The black dots are our observations, and then the line is our statistical model fit globally. It's a global model that applies to all forests, but how it fits those particular local observations. And you see, we still face a lot of challenges in these evergreen forests that don't have a strong dry season, such as in Borneo. But in other places that are more seasonal, we do a fairly good job in capturing that variation. And once we have those models, then we can combine it with our global meteorological data and come up with scaled up statistical simulations such as this. Which this, for example, shows you the woody production, the woody growth of the entire tropical forest biome, month by month, scaled up from these field observations. So it's a statistical upscaling approach, and you can see the seasonal pattern of variation. This is the woody growth of all the trees in all the tropics estimated from this approach. And then we can look at anomalies, how it varies. So if we look at the El Niño of 97-98, we can see the areas where growth really seemed to slow down during that El Niño, indicating the areas that were most stressed. And this is the reference period. And then if you look at 2015-2016, you see evidence from our data and the scaling up that Amazonia and Africa and South Africa all slowed down, but Amazonia perhaps was the most extensive in that footprint. So this corroborates what we saw from that global top-down CO2 view. And we can do this for other components of the carbon cycle, with woody growth, the respiration of CO2 from plant stems, the release of CO2 from the soil, and the total productivity. So we can come up with essentially with that Odin-Kira type diagram now, but for the entire tropics rather than for any individual site for this sort of a approach. And if we analyze those in detail, you can see this sort of pattern. So the top graph shows the anomaly in productivity, how the productivity of the tropical forest biome changed over that time. We see a dip during just after 97-98 El Niño, and then a stronger dip in this 2015-2016 El Niño. We can see the release of CO2 from plants, which shows a peak much bigger than the dip in productivity, so that the respiration is a much more important component than the reduction in production in these components. And this is the release of CO2 from the soil, which is also a very large component. So what this story tells us is it seems to be the release from the soil can be quite a large part of this story, this respiration term. Although the dip in productivity was also very large, particularly in the 2015-2016 El Niño. So using this, we can come up with our understanding from the bottom-up scaling of how the carbon balance of the tropics was shifted during the El Niño. And this is the pattern we see. We see Amazonia being a large source of carbon from these physiological measurements, Africa being a more modest thing, and Southeast Asia, peninsular Southeast Asia is quite significant, but insular Southeast Asia was not so significant in this El Niño. It didn't experience a strong enough drought in our observations. And if we compare that to this top-down CO2 mixing view of the tropics, we see that there's a broad consistency. That there are this approach also has methodological challenges, so it's far from being some sort of truth to compare against, but they both agree that Amazonia was a big part of the story. Something's happening in Africa, some disagreement about exactly where in Africa, and a little bit is happening in peninsular Southeast Asia, not so much in insular Southeast Asia. But overall, we're seeing a broadly consistent story emerging from these two completely different techniques. And with this scaling, is it large enough to explain the total flicker that we see? So this is the rate of rise of CO2 that we're trying to explain. When we have our statistical upscale model, we see it's consistent with that, so we're explaining quite a large amount of that flicker, but not all of it. There seems to be still unexplained processes. And that could be a mixture of, we still need to refine our models, we can do better with our modeling and our the data. But there are also biomes that we're missing. We're really focusing on tropical forests in this analysis. We're not looking at savanna biomes, which are extensive, and they could also be a significant component, along with other smaller biomes, such as mangroves and montane systems. But there are also processes that we're not looking at. We're looking mainly at largely forests that had a physiological response but didn't experience fire, weren't destroyed by fire, for example, during the El Nino. And those fire processes could also be a contribution that increases that amplitude. So the things that we still need to take into account to have a whole understanding. But when we compare that some of these processes to models, how are these models doing? We see there's some broad agreement, but some discrepancies. So this is the amount of CO2 being released from the soil in the models and in the observations. So the model is grey and the observations are black. And what we seem to be finding is much more release than the model suggests, and sometimes in the opposite direction. So the models here are suggesting the soils are drying in the tropics and releasing less CO2 as they get drier. But our observations suggest that actually there's more CO2 coming out. They're not drying that much, and they're actually getting warmer and releasing more CO2. So it suggests that we've got some way to go to improving our model representation. So for the final few slides, what does this mean for our understanding of the stability of the tropical forest under warming? Well, part of this seems the process seems to be down to slowing productivity, and that is something that is of concern, could be a signal of a long-term decline. The other part seems to be down to microbial activity in the soil, which may be of concern, but I venture is probably of less concern than the productivity signal. So it's a mixed story. Part of it may just be interesting interannual variability that we understand and probably isn't an early warning sign. Other parts of it may be parts of an early warning of change. So does this mean that we can relax? We're far from some sort of climate threshold in tropical forests, or are there reasons for concern? I would venture that there still are reasons for concern. And one example that I've mentioned briefly already, but is highlighted in this image, which is of some drone flights we did over near one of our sites near Santarém in Brazil, in the Tapajós National Forest. And this is an area, that first area was in primary forest, and this is adjacent areas of primary forest, area that's never been logged, but 1 year after the El Nino, half the trees are dead in this forest. And you can see the extent of that. And the reason that occurred is these events. Let me just flick back here, see that again. So that's the primary forest. Classic eastern Amazonian forest of tall, majestic trees. And we'll flick over to the next image. This is an extensive mortality. Lots of trees standing, but dead, other trees falling over. And we estimate that the total amount of carbon released in that mortality event, just in the Santarém region, was more than the total amount of carbon released by deforestation in all of Amazonia in that same year. So it's a huge, significant event. And these fires are, they're not massive crown fires like you see in images of the Mediterranean or California. These are litter fires, very small fires that you can stop by sweeping away the leaf litter, or you can walk over. And yet they have huge effects on the mortality of trees. They're killing half the trees. And we're not quite sure why, whether it's just because the bark is so thin of these humid forest trees that they're vulnerable even to slight amounts of heat stress, or whether it's the roots or the mycorrhizal systems that are being affected. But we're trying to understand that. And you can see what's happening in Amazonia is that the deforestation rates have been hovering at fairly low levels, historically fairly low levels for the last decade, but these fire events are now becoming more and more predominant, in dry years especially, but even in wet years. And the occurrence of fires in humid forests is becoming a new norm in many parts of eastern Amazonia. And this interaction between climate change and fire may be a more critical process in pushing these systems through to a tipping point, which is depressing in some senses, but also fire is something that actually is there is a more tangible local intervention. It's much harder to intervene in the global climate challenge than it is to come up with fire management strategies around these fire events in forests. They often leak from neighbouring farms, so you can have fire management in farms that minimises this leaking of fires, or you can have a fire combat service that, when you have a fire, have a system where you contain that fire by relatively little effort and this leaf litter separation, limit those effects, or have more intact humid bits of forest. So if you're logging a forest, the norm is log a forest next to your farm because it's the most accessible. But maybe you have some less susceptible old growth forest before you get to your logging concession, that can act as a buffer to these fires as well. And So, and how do we place this threat of a tipping point into it? How does it, it also feels a bit demotivating in some senses, and how do we frame this in terms of how we deal with the Anthropocene in the tropics or elsewhere? I like to use this diagram from a paper we had a few years ago that is a thing that still keeps me motivated under the challenges that we face. And this describes this bottleneck that I think we're in. This is on the left, we have these what we call our classic pristine old growth forest systems with a diversity of biotic interactions and rich fauna, lots of ecological interactions like cascades. And there's increasing pressure on these systems, and that can be described in lots of ways. But the two predominant forces of pressure that are tightening this neck are land and forest use associated drivers, deforestation, degradation, defaunation, and global climate and atmospheric associated drivers, such as increased drought frequency, drought intensity, warming temperatures. And they're both tightening this neck. But there's reason, it's not certain, but there's reason to be hopeful that these drivers in some regions, or maybe even most regions, will lessen over this century. We can hope or plan for the CO2 emissions will stabilize and start declining at some point, and we reach some sort of maximum CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, maximum level of global warming, so that climate change driver stabilizes at some point. And the forest use drivers also, there can be transitions, decreasing the intensity of pressure, more localized pressure. Some areas, as has occurred in North America, some areas face decreasing pressure over time. And so there's a chance for rehabilitation and expansion of systems. But the types of systems that may emerge from this bottleneck can be very different. They could either be reasonably functional. They'll all be different systems. Because of climate change, nowhere is going to be the same. In the remotest part of the Amazon, it's not going to be the same as it was a century ago because of climate change. But there could be functionally intact systems, or there could be greatly diminished systems, defaunated, degraded, burnt out. And the challenge we face is to manage this bottleneck, to keep these immediate pressures as light as they can. They are intense. While these longer-term trends that are more global in terms of global CO2 emissions, global demographic and economic pressures, perhaps ease the bottleneck in some parts of the tropical landscape. And that way we can hope to keep this green heart of the biosphere that's so essential to planetary function alive and functioning for the century to come. So thank you. Thank you for your support.